Tax season has an added wrinkle this year.
Kind of need as much money as I possibly can right now, and they're just taking even more of it away, is how I look at it.
What will the Affordable Care Act mean for your tax return? I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
So here's this population that never gets studied, responding dramatically at high rates very, very quickly.
We wanted to actually measure exactly what was going on in the
brains light. Brains are complex systems of connections, modulated by connections.
You are the only person in history of mankind.
And he used Lego Mindstorms to build something called
constantly refreshing the screen, looking at
us. There were chemical bombs that were connected to scary additives.
Dr. Harris, room 9 now, please.
On today's show, how science creates super athletes, how bacteria help ants survive, and how art can promote healing after devastating workplace injury. But first up, the taxman cometh, and this year, for the first time, he wants to know about your health insurance.
What does the Affordable Care Act have to do with your taxes? More than you'd think. You are going to have a lot of questions.
As a result, some people may owe the IRS more and some will get money back. Either way, Alana Gordon reports this new twist means tax preparers have kicked into high gear, getting ready for new forms, new conversations, and in some instances, unexpected headaches.
Darren Dabner just wants to get his taxes over with. But he's a little anxious this year.
Like last year, I came in and I was like, all right, I expect to get this amount back. And now here I am sitting here. Well, I could get penalized. So that's definitely money out of my pocket. So
Dabner's worried about having to pay more because he does not have health insurance. And for the first time, people who are uninsured and don't qualify for an exemption will owe Uncle Sam money, either $95 or 1% of their income, whichever is more. Dabner's 28, healthy, and just graduated from college. He sits in Bill Holtzman's tax office near the Philadelphia Art Museum to find out how much he owes.
I have to brace myself that people are going to feel devastated.
Holtzman has been in the tax business for over three decades. He dons blue corduroy pants, a button-up collared shirt, glasses, and a blue tie.
My responsibility is to give him a different perspective.
Holtzman and the hundreds of thousands of other tax professionals out there have spent an unprecedented amount of time prepping for this tax season. That's thanks in large part to big changes that kicked in this year under the Affordable Care Act. People like Dabner, who don't have insurance, may face a penalty or will have to file an exemption. Then there are the millions of people who have coverage through the Affordable Care Act's online marketplace. For them, there's a different layer of complexity.
Let me print up a form and I'll show you what it looks like.
Okay.
Like you gotta see it.
Holtzman prints out a couple new forms he's been scrutinizing a lot to make sure he's ready to go through them with clients.
This is the 8962. 14 pages.
The form is for people who got federal subsidies to help pay for their insurance premiums. The amount of assistance is based on a person's estimated income for the year. What that means is that now, during tax time, a person who earned more than they anticipated will have to pay back some of that subsidy to the IRS. On the flip side, a person who earned less may get money back.
I know I'm going to feel more stress. I have to change our workflow because of this.
A few blocks away, Stuart Katz, another tax preparer, is also feeling anxious. On a scale of 1 to 10, his level of preparedness?
I think we're about a 6 to a 7.
But it's not just the little guys who are bracing for some confused clients and added work. Kim Busby is a senior tax advisor at an H&R Block office in West Philly.
We did at least 15 hours worth of training just on the Affordable Care Act.
Think role plays and even a segment entirely focused on teaching tax preparers how to become more empathetic.
Empathy has you feel more for the person, where sympathy has you feel more about yourself. So we try to put ourselves in the client's shoes.
Busby says a successful visit will hinge on being able to really help people understand why they may owe a penalty, for example, and what they can do to prevent that in the future. Jackson Hewitt Tax Service, a competitor to H&R Block, has also been putting in extra resources to ready their tens of thousands of preparers.
Here's a couple of ways you might think about approaching it with your customers. First, you can ask them, Did you know that the ACA is really just a tax law?
They designed their own online curriculum that features infographics, talking points, and role-playing.
Let's say that a family comes to see you, the tax pro, on April 7th. Now, let's say that family answers the questions in the ACA Accelerator.
Jackson Hewitt's chief tax officer, Mark Stieber, doesn't think the tax season will actually be as rocky as some preparers might be anticipating. He says, keep in mind, most people already have insurance and really won't be affected.
I would fully estimate about 80% of the tax-paying public will have very minimal impact on their tax return. That is to say, they had insurance coverage for they and their family for the whole year.
And that basically involves checking off a box. But Stieber is anxious about one thing. The deadline for individuals to enroll in health insurance through the marketplace is 2 months before the deadline to file taxes.
Enrollment ends on February 15th. Quite a number of taxpayers will not have filed their tax returns by then and will maybe not know they owe a penalty or may not realize that they're going to owe a triple or a double size penalty next year.
But by then, it will be too late to sign up for coverage. As for Darren Dabner, who came into Bill Holtzman's office to get his taxes done.
All right, so your consultation has ended.
Yep.
What happened?
I got a penalty.
He'll have to pay the minimum $95.
Not as much as I thought, so I guess there's a silver lining here.
Dabner says he's now weighing his options. Should he sign up for health coverage through the marketplace or not, and face a much greater fine next year for being uninsured? Open enrollment ends February 15th, so he'll have 2 more weeks to decide. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. From taxes on to more stuff that gives us headaches. Winter. Winter weather.
Do you want to build a snowman?
Oh yeah, we were going to build an entire army of snowmen this week with the foot of snow winter storm Juno was going to dump on us, and then...
It doesn't have to be a snowman.
It wasn't going to be a snowman. We got almost no snow here in the Philadelphia region. A dusting, a few inches in some places. So what happened there? Everybody seems to love to hate weather forecasters, but let's talk about their job and what it entails. Joining us now is Tom Thunstrom. He's editor and co-publisher of PhillyWeather.com. It's a website that features forecasts and also talks about the people making those forecasts. Tom, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So what happened with this storm?
That's the question everybody's asked. It was a difficult forecast to begin with. I think one of the things that was not communicated clearly across the board is how this storm was going to evolve. It was pretty clear from the get-go Boston was going to get hit hard. New York, yeah, it looked like they were going to get hit. They didn't get hit as bad. But Philadelphia was on the fence from the get-go. And if the storm had developed fast enough, had developed quickly enough, we would have picked up a foot of snow. And, you know, obviously that didn't happen. Part of that was due to the development of the storm, how these storms come together. They have to come together perfectly. And this nature, the type of storm that we're talking about, when we were dealing with an Alberta Clipper developing off the coast, they have to develop quick enough to throw precipitation back into Philadelphia. That didn't happen. And as a result, the snowfall forecasts that were out there pretty much went up in smoke.
What made this storm so hard to forecast? What were some of the elements that made it difficult?
You were dealing with an Alberta Clipper that was
What is that?
An Alberta Clipper is it's a low-pressure center that originates in Alberta and moves relatively quickly. That's why they call it a Clipper, like a Clipper ship. When it hits the coast, sometimes these lows intensify, and sometimes rather rapidly. This was one of those scenarios where it was supposed to intensify quite rapidly, and it did for Boston. They got 3 feet of snow. But because of the track of the low, it didn't quite intensify fast enough to put snow into our region.
Where do forecasters get their information from, and then what do they do? Do they crunch the numbers? Do they have different systems and approaches?
They do. There's about five major computer models that are out there. And computer model, think of it as plain sims, only you're using actual surface data, upper atmospheric data. It gets crunched into a supercomputer and spits out a simulation of what's going to happen over a period of hours, days, or weeks, depending upon which computer simulation you run with. Some computer models tend to perform better than others. We had one computer model, which is called the European computer model. It's based in Europe, that on Saturday afternoon had Philadelphia getting 24 inches of snow from that snowstorm. By Sunday afternoon, it was down to 15. By Monday morning, it was down to 9. So there was a clear trend that the snowfall totals were not going in a favorable direction. From that point, you look at other guidance. There's two or three American-based computer models and one that's based in Canada as well. And looking at the average of all of those, plus throwing in a little bit of a bias towards models that tend to perform better, like the European, forecasters tend to come up with a forecast.
And the data that the models use comes from where?
It comes from surface observations. You know, at the airport, for instance, there's a temperature sensor there and wind barometer, all of that. And also from atmospheric balloons that are launched twice a day by the Weather Service. They send a balloon up through the atmosphere and it measures temperature, measures pressure, wind speed, wind direction.
Is this region a tough place to forecast weather?
Yes.
How so?
With the Alberta Clipper type storms that may or may not develop, it's one factor that you look at. Being less than 50 miles from the ocean in Philadelphia, that's another factor you have to look at, because if a storm tracks or low pressure center tracks relatively close to Philly, you get the influence of the Atlantic Ocean, milder air gets drawn into a storm, and what may be snow ends up as rain or freezing rain. You also have the Gulf Stream, which is not that far away from us. It runs up to about Hatteras and then out into the Atlantic. So, depending upon which direction winds are flowing ahead of that storm, you could get some pretty mild air into the Philly in advance of a storm. That's why it can get to 60 or 65 in January or February around here on occasion. You get some mild winds because of that warm ocean. So, it makes it more difficult than some other places like Chicago or Minneapolis where, it doesn't snow as heavily. It snows consistently, though.
What's your prediction for the rest of the winter?
We have a pretty decent window of opportunity in terms of snow. If you like snow, it's a decent window. If you hate snow, you're going to hate it. starting in about a week and running through probably President's Day weekend, that might be our best shot in terms of getting more than this nickel and dime nuisance stuff that we've been getting this winter. It's going to be colder next week, and it matches up statistically with when we normally get our most snow, pretty much between now and the last week of February is historically our most snowy period on average. So if we get any snow, that's probably our best shot at it. And then, from there, we'll see what happens.
Do you like snow?
Do I like snow? Big storms, yes. I don't like the 2 to 3 inch nuisance where it's like a 3-hour commute to work type.
So everything...
If you're going to shut the city down, I want all in. That's the kind of snow I like, or at least from it's a snow day for a day or two, but...
So either a couple of feet or nothing.
Correct.
Tom, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tom Thunstrom is the editor and co-publisher at phillyweather.com. Coming up on The Pulse, what's this strange noise? It's an iceberg off Antarctica running aground. And wait till you find out where and how this was recorded. Stay tuned to The Pulse right here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence believes in living like nothing can hold you down. But to live worry-free, you need someone to fall back on. That's why they offer doctors and hospitals across the region and a range of health plans designed to help fit your budget. Independence is here to help. This year, you may be eligible for financial support. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. More information at IBX.com or 1-800-ASK-BLUE.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca promotes health and science education and disease awareness through initiatives such as the Young Health Program, which helps young people build personal qualities to live healthy, successful lives. Launched in the U.S. in partnership with the United Way of Delaware, the Young Health Program has reached nearly 12,000 young people since 2012. More about the Young Health Program can be found online at im40.org.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Forget winter. We're going to take a dip into the ocean, a very deep dip, 1,000 meters down, where some peculiar physics happens. At this depth, sound waves don't behave the same way they do on land or even in other parts of the ocean. It's a strange acoustical phenomenon that played a secretive role in the nation's military history. And there's a monster. Todd Bookman takes it from here.
Before we can talk of submarines and surveillance and monsters, we first need a little insight into underwater acoustics.
Okay. The name is Peter Worcester. I'm a research oceanographer at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography.
Worcester has been at Scripps in San Diego since 1978, and he's going to help explain how the SOFAR channel works.
The SOFAR channel stands for the Sound Fixing and Ranging Channel, and it's a result of how the speed of sound varies with depth in the ocean.
There's two things that determine how sound travels in the ocean, temperature and pressure. In warmer waters near the surface, sound waves move faster. But sound waves also move faster down deep, where pressures are higher. Think of these as a floor and ceiling. Sandwiched in between, there's this sweet spot, a layer of the Earth's oceans where sound waves move nice and slow, the SOFAR channel. In most of the planet's oceans, it lies between 800 and 1,000 meters below the surface. And what's interesting is that once waves get into the SOFAR channel, they get stuck there, ping-ponging off the warmer water above and higher pressure water just below.
What this does is it means that this sound doesn't interact with the surface or the seafloor.
The waves are basically trapped, and with nothing in the way to sap their energy, they just keep fanning out.
So it can travel long distances before it's absorbed by the processes in the ocean that reduce sound.
We're talking hundreds, sometimes thousands of miles. This is a recording from inside the SOFAR channel. What you're hearing is an iceberg off Antarctica running aground. A powerful underwater microphone called a hydrophone is picking up the commotion loud and clear from 150 miles away. Researchers first discovered the SOFAR channel in the 1940s. Actually, two teams, one American, one Soviet, working independently of each other, confirmed the channel's properties basically at the same time.
Of course, these two groups didn't realize that they both found the same phenomena until many years later when one could actually talk about such things.
Remember, this wasn't an era of broad scientific sharing. For the Americans, the immediate thought was, how could the SOFAR channel be used to help win World War II? The military came up with one sort of far-fetched idea. What if they could load American fighter planes with a small explosive charge in case they were shot down over water? The bomb would be programmed to detonate in the SOFAR.
And so the notion was that the flyers would drop these devices that would make a sound, and then there would be hydrophones scattered around the ocean basin that would record these sounds. And then one could triangulate on where the downed flyer was and go locate the person.
That system, though, never got completely off the ground. The war was over within a year. But, ever vigilant, the military soon sees new promise in the SOFAR.
Of course, one of the first thoughts during the early part of the Cold War was how would one track Soviet submarines?
Loud diesel-powered Soviet subs. The U.S. Navy, with the help of Bell Labs, began work on a secret operation dubbed Project Jezebel, placing hydrophones around the North Atlantic. They were looking for the low rumbles that would serve as warning of an enemy sub on the move. In time, a vast underwater surveillance system was in place. But it didn't always work as intended.
The sailors manning the systems would record these low-frequency sounds at about 18 hertz, 18 cycles per second. And they had absolutely no idea what they were. And at least the story I've heard is that they referred to these sounds as coming from the Jezebel monster. Nowadays, we know that the Jezebel monster was fin and blue whales. They both vocalize at around 18 hertz. And so we now know what they are.
The SOFAR listening system did wind up tracking more than chatty whales. It successfully detected a Soviet sub during the Cuban Missile Crisis and remained in use right up through the end of the Cold War. Today, there's still hydrophones dotting the world's oceans. Researchers like Peter Wooster use them to study ocean temperature and current, as well as the impact of freighter traffic on marine life. They're also important for mapping seismic activity. Like this small underwater earthquake heard 300 miles away in the eastern Pacific. Instead of eavesdropping on the Soviets, scientists are now tuning their ears to other sounds filling up the world's oceans and taking advantage of the SOFAR's unique properties to do it from long distances. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
Special thanks to Bob Ziak with NOAA's Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory in Newport, Oregon, for providing our SOFAR samples. You're listening to The Pulse. Ants are great at working together, right? When they carry those pine needles or breadcrumbs into their nest to feed their queen and the young. But inside of each ant, more collaboration happens on a micro level. In this edition of our series, So What Do You Do?, where we pair laypeople with scientists for down-to-earth conversations, writer Adrian Simpson talks to Drexel University biologist Jake Russell about his fascination with organisms inside of ants. To get things started, Simpson asked Russell,
So, what do you do?
Well, I'm a biologist. I study symbiosis, which is basically interactions between organisms that are very intimate and prolonged.
Now, you study symbiosis in ants in particular?
We study ants that are vegetarian for the most part, partly because that's a pretty unique lifestyle for an ant to have. Like humans, ants have pretty large quantities of bacteria in their guts, and we have been interested in kind of describing those communities of bacteria in particular, and also being able to understand their functions and their roles in ants' dietary ecology.
So how do the bacteria that you're studying sort of help the ant? What benefit is it, and how do they sort of allow an ant to remain a vegetarian ant, so to speak?
Well, it looks like a given ant colony for the species that we study tends to basically be united in having very, very similar gut bacteria. So workers seem to be sharing bacteria with one another, and they probably have all received them from the queen. And the short answer is that it looks like they might be providing them with useful sources of nitrogen. For instance, they can take things like urea, which is kind of a waste product, and they can convert that into amino acids. The ants can use the amino acids. The urea for them would really normally just be kind of a waste. So that is one of the ways that we think that these bacteria are actually benefiting the ants, and we have some direct evidence for that now.
What is it about ants in particular and their lifestyle that interests you?
There's a lot of different things. So the ants are really, really diverse. There's over 12,000 described species, and they live pretty much everywhere except Antarctica. They are among the world's most abundant animals in terms of number as well as biomass. If you put them on the scale and you stack them up against pretty much any other animal that lives on land, ants would weigh more, which is pretty cool. They've evolved a really diverse array of lifestyles. So some of them are really good at protecting plants from things that would eat the plants. Some of them drink the blood of their own young. I'm really fond of the ants that don't bite and don't sting. Some of these herbivores that we study are not biting us and not stinging us, and that's always really much appreciated. They seem to have evolved these really interesting exoskeletons. They're very, very thick and probably makes sense because these ants have seemed to not really be very well defended. And they've also evolved this one caste. It's called a major caste or maybe a soldier caste. Workers that develop to be quite large, but they have these very, very large heads that are flattened, and they use them to plug the holes to their nest entrances. So they're almost like little doors or even bulldozers, and this is sort of the way by which these ants, turtle ants as they're called, they keep things out of their nest by using these pretty passive defenses. And if things do get in, they happen to have pretty thick skin.
So everything in that movie Ants was true?
Well, maybe not exactly.
As humans, we tend to think of ants as a nuisance. So the next time I see an ant in my kitchen, what are some of the higher attributes I should consider before going to get some ant spray?
Sure. Well, I think that many of the ants that do end up in your house are things you don't want there. So I think it's fair to kind of have that knee-jerk reaction if you have carpenter ants or something along those lines. And it's something you don't really want to keep around. But even things like carpenter ants, which I think scare people, they rely on bacteria that actually provide them with nutrition that they're not getting from their diets. So I think the next time that you maybe come across a carpenter ant in your home, you might have some appreciation for the fact that they're really not independent entities. They are creatures that are the product of a symbiosis between a bacterium that's been there in that case for tens of millions of years and the ants themselves, which have become completely reliant on the bacteria to do really useful things for it.
Thanks so much for your time and for telling us all we need to know about ants and their guts.
Thank you.
New Jersey writer Adrian Simpson talking to Drexel University biologist Jake Russell. Coming up on The Pulse, a scientific approach to engineering super athletes.
People always used to think that tall men couldn't be sprinters because the thought was that they couldn't turn over their legs fast enough, that the strides wouldn't come quickly enough. It turns out that that isn't how you run faster. You run faster by applying more force while your foot is on the ground.
Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse and believes that everyone should make the most of every moment. That's why they offer doctors and hospitals across the region and a range of health plans designed to help fit your budget. More at IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Actively supporting nonprofit organizations to increase disease awareness, prevention, and access to medicines in the Philadelphia region, AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. Learn more by visiting AstraZeneca-US.com.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. When you watch the Patriots and the Seahawks compete in the Super Bowl, you should say a big thank you to science. Yes, science. Today's star athletes get a lot of their skills, endurance, and gear through refined techniques developed by scientists. And joining us now to talk more is Mark McCluskey. He's the editor of Wired.com, and his new book is Faster, Higher, Stronger, How Sports Science is Creating a New Generation of Super Athletes and What We Can Learn from Them. Mark, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with an NFL workout. What's the role of science in optimizing an NFL player's workout?
In terms of a strength training workout, for instance, we all respond very differently to strength training. There's actually a genetic component to, you know, if you and I did the same weightlifting program, we'd have different results. And that's true even at the elite level. So one player might respond better to heavier weights and fewer repetitions. One might respond better to lighter weights and more repetitions.
You visited labs that try to improve these processes. What does it take to understand what will work for an individual athlete? How do we know this guy or this woman will respond to X approach?
The sort of holy grail, of course, is this idea that I can do a genetic test on you or do some other set of tests on you and suddenly know what might be more or less effective for you. We're not anywhere near that point. We see hints of genes that might be involved in that, of traits that we know are genetically influenced that must be involved in it, but it's really hard to tease those out in a easy test. So it's still much more, you know, you try something, you capture the results, and if they're not working or if you're not progressing, you try something else. It's kind of like a little science experiment with one subject, and that's each individual athlete.
But I guess scientists have gotten much more refined in measuring, for example, the impact of an athlete's foot or how they are lifting something or which muscles are engaged in a certain process.
Exactly. It's you can quantify what an athlete does at a much more granular level than before. The boom we've had in sensor technology, whether it be something as simple as wearing a Jawbone Up or a Nike Fuel Band to capture motion, or something as complex as really high-end video analytics where I'm filming an athlete performing an action and then really breaking down what angle is their femur at a certain point in their stride. We can get so much more information about what an athlete is doing in that performative moment that it opens up many more vectors to improve it. You know, what you can see with the naked eye only takes you a very short way down the road that we're able to travel now through the technology we have.
You give an example in your book about Usain Bolt and the kind of the importance of the force with which a runner's foot hits the ground. Talk a bit about that.
Sure. People always used to think that tall men couldn't be sprinters because the thought was that they couldn't turn over their legs fast enough, that the strides wouldn't come quickly enough. It turns out that that isn't how you run faster. You run faster by applying more force while your foot is on the ground. And so somebody like Usain Bolt, when he hits the ground, is hitting the ground with close to 1,000 pounds of force. And he certainly couldn't do a 1,000-pound single leg squat
right.
in the weight room, but somehow he's able to generate that force on the track. You know, he could probably do a 500-pound single leg squat in the weight room. Incidentally, he's massively strong in the legs. That's the only way you can develop that force. But it appears that the biomechanics of how we apply that force during running are different than how we apply it during weightlifting.
What about gear? A lot of research goes into optimizing gear, and then gear becomes really expensive. How important is that, and what can we achieve through science there?
It's incredibly important, especially in some sports in particular. A lot of listeners might remember in the past 5 or 6 years, swimsuits became this very high-tech thing with all these polymers, and they were basically flotation devices for the swimmers.
Right.
They would trap a layer of air, and you would float. You would be more buoyant. Every swimming world record was annihilated by swimmers wearing these suits. And then they were banned. And what's interesting there is the conversation. And to me, it's about sort of the equipment distorting what we think the sport measures. You know, we're very comfortable with sports like Formula One, which are, to some large extent, an engineering and scientific competition, right? Who can come up with a technical innovation that defeats the competition? Drivers are incredible athletes and hugely important, but the engineers are perhaps more important. In swimming with the suits, it seemed like suddenly the swimmer was less important and the suit was more important. And that those are those moments where we get uncomfortable when the equipment starts to distort what we think the sport is measuring.
I'm wondering, where does this end? It seems to me that at some point, as humans, we simply won't be able to be faster, stronger, jump higher. Is there an end point in this quest?
Well, so, you know, logically, one assumes that there is. We haven't found it yet. What we found is that our improvement seems to be slowing. And I think that that's because we've figured out a lot of the quote unquote easy stuff. Not that any of this is terribly easy.
Yeah.
And so what you're looking for now is 0.1% here, 0.1% there.
But in the end, it seems like there are some human factors we won't be able to control, like having a bad day or a momentary, whatever, brain fart, where things just don't go your way.
Well, and that's why we play the games, right? You know, with if it was so predictable, we'd, you know, before a bike race, you'd submit your training diary and and you're, you know, here's my VO2 max, here's how much oxygen I can process, and like we declare a winner. We wouldn't have to ride the Tour de France. you know, if, you know, the sort of reducto absurdum of it is that, yeah, you could just like have a spreadsheet and call it a day. That's why we watch. That's the, you know, when you talk about the romance, to me, that's the romance. It's the unpredictability. It's the an athlete doing something that he or she didn't even know they could do on a particular day. It's that flash of insight. It's Clay Thompson 2 nights ago. I'm a Warriors fan, like scoring 37 points in a quarter. He couldn't miss. He took 13 shots in the quarter and made all of them, set a new NBA record. Those are the moments that And those moments, I think, exist in every game. If you're watching really, really closely, in any game, you'll see something that you never saw before.
Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Mark McCluskey is the editor of Wired.com, and his new book is Faster, Higher, Stronger: How Sports Science is Creating a New Generation of Super Athletes and What We Can Learn from Them. Harder, better, faster, stronger. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. If you get hurt on the job, your life can turn into an odyssey of doctors, insurance claims, and lawyers. It's like you've been reduced to the contents of your case file. A local law firm specializing in workers' compensation cases has turned case files back into people. The firm is called Pond Lee Hockey Stern & Giordano, and they asked the British artist Ian Wright to tear up the papers in the files of selected clients to make collage portraits out of those pieces. The series is called Torn Apart and now hangs in their offices. One of the clients featured, George Beerley, is wheelchair-bound due to an on-the-job trauma. And for this week's edition of our series Patient Files, he tells us how he feels about being torn apart and put back together.
My name's George Beerley. My nickname is Moose. I was a heavy equipment operator out of local 542. We were doing a job up in Buckingham, late winter of 2008. I had to drill holes in the concrete so they could pull it out with this big machine, like a jackhammer sort of, but it's a spinning device. The attachment was about 5 foot high. So every time I had to get out of the machine, I had to climb up over top of this big machinery, and there's a safety bar. When you pull the safety bar up, everything is safe. Nothing's supposed to work because everything is shut down. So I was stepping over top of this 5 foot mechanism, and I happened to hit a pedal that would raise the machine up. I wasn't concerned because I had the safety bar up. Well, next thing I know, I was like up against the roof, and this mechanic was standing there. His name was Donnie. I said, "Don, what the hell happened?" And I looked at my right foot, and instead of looking at my toe, I was looking at the heel of my foot, and it didn't hurt. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, something's not right here. How come this doesn't hurt me? My ankle got spun around completely. I went down to Jefferson, and I saw one of the Rothman doctors, the orthopedic guys. They weren't going to do any surgery on the ankle because they knew I would probably never walk again, you know, and which is the truth. My injury was, they call it a thoracic, which is T18-9, which is like just below your nipple line. So I'm paralyzed from there down. I don't want to sue anybody. Why? I'm not a sewer. I'm not, you know, why would I ever want to get in a situation where I would sue somebody, never realizing that getting hurt on a construction job, I'm going to need a lawyer. Just to, not to sue an insurance company, but just get what I'm entitled to. People don't realize when you're paralyzed, there's a lot of things that go with it. Your bowels go bad, or you have problems with your bladder. I was bedridden so long that I started having pulmonary issues. You end up with bed sores that it can actually kill you, which I had. They call it osteomyelitis. See, I have to do, matter of fact, I should do one now. I do it like a weight shift. I tilt back for like 5 minutes, just to get the pressure off my butt. So I might just pull over. I'm not going anywhere, I'm just gonna do a tilt back. So I do this stuff, and I drive, I have my own van. I've done surprisingly well. I had a situation where years ago I lost a daughter. She was 17 years old, and that was the worst thing in my life. This is bad, but it's not as bad as losing my daughter. So I think I can handle this. I mean, I have my bad days, but I always bounce back. With my daughter's situation, I learned to be able to deal with it. I'll never get over it, but I've learned to deal with it. So this here, I learned to deal with it.
That was George Bearley. He's one of the people featured in the Torn Paper Portrait series by artist Ian Wright. Peter Crimmins produced this piece. The portraits are not publicly accessible, but you can see them on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Avery Brookins is our intern. Charlie Kyer is the engineer. Joel Patterson, our associate producer. Megan Pinto is our executive producer. Chris Satullo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey, our chief content officer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, you'll have something to listen to during the next big snowstorm. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.